This episode is brought to you by Liquid IV. When you hydrate with Liquid IV, you're powered by HydraScience. HydraScience is Liquid IV's science-backed formula with an optimized ratio of electrolytes, vitamins, and nutrients. Experience great-tasting hydration for mental clarity, physical endurance, and overall well-being. Sip into something that up-levels every moment. Liquid IV. Tear. Pour. Live more. Visit us at liquidiv.com.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
This episode is brought to you by the Inspire Collection by Kalia. Just because you're working out doesn't mean you shouldn't look fabulous. The Inspire Collection by Kalia was designed with both style and performance in mind. It looks good, feels good, and stays put no matter how you move. And the collection has everything you need for a day at the gym. A support bra, crop tanks, bike shorts, amazing leggings, and more. It's their most versatile collection yet. Shop the Inspire Collection by Kalia now, exclusively at Dick's Sporting Goods.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hello everyone, I'm Sarah Carradine, podcasting from unceded Gadigal land.
I'm Mari Forth.
And this is Crime Scene, the True Crime Review podcast, where we get to the heart of how true crime stories are told. You can get this fine program, along with all the fantastic reality TV content, by subscribing to robhasawebsite.com/rahapupsfeed, that's R-H-A-P-U-P-S feed.
We'd also love it if you would subscribe to our feed. You can do that by going to robhasawebsite.com/crimefeed. You'll get your true crime on Tuesdays. And if you're already subscribed, thank you very much. Sarah, what did we watch this week?
We watched American Manhunt, the Boston Marathon bombing. It's a 3-part docuseries on Netflix. It's directed by Floyd Russ. Now, he also directed Untold, Malice at the Palace, which is extremely good. It's about the brawl at the end of the basketball game between the Indiana Pacers and the Detroit Pistons in November of 2004. So it's a great documentary, and I can completely recommend that, as does Mari. A friend of the show, Rebecca Lavoy, has a fascinating interview up currently with Floyd Russ about this Boston Marathon bombing documentary. On her podcast, You Can't Make This Up, and we'll link that in the show notes. And putting her toe to the starting line with us is ultra runner, podcaster, and my favorite Jimmy. It's Mary Kwiatkowski. Mary, welcome to the scene.
Hi. Hi, Sarah. Hi, Mari. I'm really excited to be here. This is something new for me. This is the first time that I've talked on a podcast about a documentary, about the first time I've talked about a true crime topic of anything. So I'm really excited to talk about this. I'm heartbroken having to relive all of this, but I imagine that that's kind of what most people who get into true crime content deal with every time they listen to something or watch something. So it was a new experience for me, but it was eye-opening and just it's such a amazing story of a community coming together around a horrific event. So We have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, we do. Yes. So are you normally a true crime watcher? What's your relationship generally with the true crime genre?
Yeah, and probably not as much as most people who come on here. I listened to the first season of Serial. So yes. We've got that. I recall watching a couple Lifetime movies that were about based on true stories of horrific things.
Ripped from the headlines.
Oh, yes. And I have myself been, I would say, adjacent to a couple sort of true crime topics. Not directly myself, but, you know, I went to college at Virginia Tech, which has its own history with horrific events. So I would say more recently, it's been sort of like looking at Wikipedia pages in depth of serial killers and things and then questioning myself, why did I do that? So that's more of my experience. I don't consume as much true crime content just because it makes me sad. It affects me. Yeah. So, but I do really, really enjoy documentaries. And so, this was something, this topic, which we'll get into, is something that was pretty personal to me. And also something that, the way that they formatted the piece and being a three-part documentary, I think was really well constructed. So,
Yeah, no argument from us there, I don't think. So let's get to the crime. The Boston Marathon bombing was a domestic terrorist attack. It took place during the annual Boston Marathon on Patriots Day, April 15th, 2013. Brothers Tamerlan and Jahar Zamayev planted two homemade pressure cooker bombs and detonated them near the finish line of the race. The detonations were 14 seconds and 190 meters apart. So it's 210 yards, so very close. Three people were killed. They were Martin Richard, Lingzi Liu, and Crystal Campbell. Hundreds were injured, including 17 who lost limbs. What followed was a 101-hour manhunt by the FBI and Massachusetts law enforcement, leading to the death of MIT campus cop Sean Collier, the death of Tamerlan, and the apprehension of Jahar. 2 years after the bombing, Jahar was found guilty and sentenced to death. The death sentence was overturned on appeal, but reinstated by the Supreme Court in 2022, and he's currently being held in Supermax Federal Prison, waiting to be executed. That's a very brief summary of a complex 101 hours, which this documentary covers minute by minute, basically. Mm-hmm. Let's just step back before we dive into Boston itself. Mary and I are runners. I run marathons. Mary's an ultra marathoner. A marathon is 42.2 kilometers, which is 26.2 miles. And you can run it in anything from a couple of hours to 7 hours to 10 hours. The marathon community is very inclusive. And it's one of the only sports that you do that you are in the field with the elites of your sport. I ran Berlin at the end of last year, and Kipchoge made the world record, which was just, he's trying to get under 2 hours. He will do it. And I was much, much longer than that. So there's a huge marathon community. I'm trying not to talk too much about it because there is a joke. How do you know if someone's run a marathon? Don't worry, they'll tell you. But it is a special thing that once you do it and you get your first medal, you say, no one can take this away from me. Mm-hmm. And I was reminded when I watched the documentary of the sort of immense running community, short, tall, fat, thin, legs, no legs, every style, everything is there. And the volunteers and the spectators that watch you do it. So I've done four. I'm on my way to an Abbott's medal, and Boston is the last one that I'll be able to do. My time currently qualifies me for Boston if I was over 80. it's the absolute pinnacle of the world marathons. And so I'll probably get in by ballot. So you just put a ballot in to get in. And before I go to you, Mary, I'll just say the one that when I messaged you, I'm watching the documentary and sobbing, it was seeing that finishing shoot, which is the most extraordinary feeling. I mean, I'm tearing up just sort of with joy and memory of that moment when you come along that finishing shoot, which is quite long. It's quite a number of meters long. It was the barriers that got me, because there are barriers between the runners and the spectators, obviously, for safety. And my thinking was, where do you go? Like, how do you escape? So I had a very claustrophobic feeling, which is not my usual feeling, coming up that finishing shoot. But Mary, I know it's even more personal for you.
Yes. So like Sarah said, I'm also a runner. I have run several marathons, not personally the Boston Marathon, but like Sarah sort of alluded to, if you don't know, but you're listening to this because you're interested, the Boston Marathon is sort of one of the pinnacles of a running achievement. If you're a marathon runner, a lot of people will try to get into the Boston Marathon because it's one of the few marathons in the United States where you need to qualify. You have a set time that you need to get, and it's extremely competitive to get in. So even if you make your time, you may not necessarily get in. There are sort of some extra things you can do to try and guarantee your spot, but mostly it's based on speed just because it's that popular. It's one of the oldest marathons, possibly even the oldest in the United States.
It is. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. It began in 1897, and in the year that the documentary is about, the Boston Marathon was celebrating its 117th race. The Boston Marathon takes place on Patriots Day every year, which is the second, third Monday in April, I believe. And it just happened when we're recording this, the Boston mm-hmm. Marathon happened yesterday. I had several friends running in it. But for myself, I've been to the Boston Marathon three times. I went last year. That was the most recent time I went. I've had three immediate family members run it. My father, my mother, and my brother have all run it. My brother ran it last year as his second official marathon. So I was super proud of him for being able to qualify on his first. But the first time I went was in 2006. And so I was 11 years old, spectating my dad as he was running, as me and my brother and sister, who were all, you know, children under 13. My brother was 9 at the time. And Sarah, when I was watching this, I started definitely getting choked up and crying, as I am now thinking about it, because being a spectator who is in that finishing area, if you've ever been to a marathon, it ranges on the finishing shoot, which could be a turn, it could be a stretch, or in the Boston Marathon's case, it's several blocks of Boylston Street. It's extremely difficult to maneuver around there. Even as a spectator, you can't get on the course. There's barricades, but you can stand along the sidewalks on either side of Boylston Street. If you wanted to, for example, get from one side of the finish line to the other, you would have to walk blocks out of your way and then circle all the way around, probably walking at least a few miles to get from one side to the other, because they block off so deep. It's extremely crowded. You're packed in. And there's a lot of celebration and excitement in the air. But also, if you're a person like me who can get a little nervous around crowds or claustrophobic, that's what you're dealing with. So when I went the first time, my mom was trying to corral, you know, three young children, keep an eye on them in the crowd. And I remember vividly, we ended up walking to a Walgreens a few blocks along the course, buying some little $5 chairs to sit in and huddle up right next to the barricade when we had kind of finally found our spot. People get to the finish line of the Boston Marathon hours before the race starts, even though the race is a point to point, and it's going to be hours before the lead people get there, because you need to secure your spot. For me, the part that made me choke up so much was the first time I went there, the exact spot we were sitting in is in front of a Starbucks at the corner of Boylston and Ring Street. And it is the exact spot that the second bomb went off. Exactly. Mm. They say it's in front of the Forum restaurant, I remember trying to go into the Forum restaurant to go to the bathroom, but we couldn't. All the restaurants had signs saying only for paying customers. So we went into the Starbucks next door to pay to go to the bathroom. We were sitting exactly there. The day that the bombing happened, my mom was watching the footage and on TV because it's live. And she goes, "Oh my gosh, that's where we were. That's exactly where we were." You mentioned Martin Richard, who is one of the three people killed in the bombing, is an 8-year-old, practically my brother's age when we were there in that exact spot. So even though I wasn't there the year of the race, I had been there in 2010. So I had been there 3 years prior to the race again for the second time I went when my mom and my dad both ran. We were standing across the street, but right on that same finishing area, right across the street. And would have seen everything happened had it been that year. The year 2013 that it happened, I was sitting, I remember, in my band room. You know, I feel like this is like one of those things, like much like 9/11, where for certain people, they remember exactly where they were when they heard. And I was sitting in the band room in my high school. It was my senior year of high school. And when we heard, all of these people started asking me, Mary, is your dad there? Because they knew that my dad had run in 2006, 2007, 2010, 2012. He had run the year before. Mm. And so they knew, like, this is a thing that he typically does. Relatives were asking if he was there, whether or not he was running or spectating or anything. And I knew he wasn't, but I was just panicking, thinking, who do I know who is there? Because a bunch of people from my community, the running community in Charlottesville, Virginia, go. And it was just shocking to think this is something that's happening. You know, I mentioned the Virginia Tech shooting. This is like the second time in a short span of years where I'm thinking this is too close for comfort. This is something that, so my dad did end up going the next year as well, which a lot of people did to sort of run in remembrance and to support Boston. But for me, watching this documentary, it was just so personal of looking and pausing and looking at the maps and seeing that's where we would have been had we been there. Because, you know, you never know exactly how one thing happens. It's a crowd of people. Maybe you wouldn't. But if my dad had chosen to run that year and we had been there, we probably would have been in that almost identical spot. So it's just things like that you think of. And this is, you know, I say all this not to take away from the people who actually were there, but just to, you know, a lot of people associate things with their own life and their own experiences. And it's something that I didn't just have to imagine, like, what, you know, what could it have been like? It's like, I know what it would have been like.
Yeah.
Well,
thank you
for telling us all that, Mary.
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to say. I just want to say thank you both for sharing your experiences. My time in a marathon is 000 because I have never run a marathon. I will never run a marathon. And I have like such high esteem and regard for the two of you who do in the running community, who have in the past and do it in the future, because it is something so like just reverent to be able to push your body to that, to do that. And something I will never understand, but I definitely love hearing your guys' firsthand experience of not just the running community itself. Thank you so much, Mary, for sharing that story with us. And it's true. It's like, yeah, we're not taking away from other people's stories by sharing ours, because like you said, you know, you were right there like any other year. So to have that insight on the podcast, we're really glad to have you on for this. And I mean, I think I can safe to say that I thought this was a really good property, and I can't wait to really dive deep into it with the both of you.
And something that I just want to add that is it's like, it's weird how the little things can bother you. Like, I'm the kind of person who, when I watch a scripted content, when I watch a TV show, I'll feel sad for like, oh, the poor man at the store who gets bowled over in the chase scene, you know, like it's not real. I'll get sad for that. And just watching it and thinking, for all of the people who were told the race is canceled when they're close to finishing, I was like, obviously there is a terrorist attack going on right now. That is the priority. Obviously nobody is arguing that, but I just so felt for those people to say they've worked for this. Most people don't run any marathons ever.
Train for 20. Well, oh, so yeah. Different times, but my training starts 20 weeks out, and that's on a basis of already running.
Yeah.
So to train for 20 weeks to get to that particular, I mean, the elites had already gone past, so mm-hmm. That's slightly different. But I remember when the bombing happened when I first saw it on television, I honestly thought, oh my God, those poor people for being turned away. Now, they were sound of limb, and I mean, it's still shocking, but they didn't really know what had happened. And when I saw that section very briefly in the documentary, my heart clutched again. I thought, you do all of that and you're turned away. And you could see how hard it was for law enforcement to get them to turn away, because you're in such a, by that point, you're in such a mindset of you're almost there and your body is breaking down, and you know that you're running. The finish line's here. I'm pointing to my forehead. We say this, the finish line's up here. So to see them, and they're they couldn't even comprehend what was being said to them.
Yeah, and with the exception of the COVID-19 pandemic in 2020 and how that sort of rescheduled things in 2021, 2013 I think was one of the only other years where the participants who didn't complete it, but who completed at least half the course in that time period, but weren't able to finish, were given automatic entry in 2014. I know. So hopefully some of them got to run again. Right. It sounds silly. It's like, oh, it's a marathon. But the reason I started with talking about Boston for clarity is like, if most people don't run any marathons in their life, some people will run one. For the people who run Boston, you pretty much have to have qualified by running another race, unless you're a celebrity. There's a few celebrities who've run the Boston Marathon. but for the people who have qualified, it's weeks of training, but potentially months to years of getting to that point and being able to do it. I've been running long distance since I was 12, and I have been running marathons for the last like 5 years. And I know that the only way I'm making a Boston Marathon qualifying time is waiting until I'm in the 50, 60, 70, 80 year, bracket, because I know I can't make the times that you need to right now. So
I'm lucky, because for international runners like myself, I haven't ever put in a ballot for Boston, but if you put in a ballot unsuccessfully for 5 years in a row, you do get entry in the sixth year. So you can see we're slightly, overdoing our information here for those of you who don't run, but Boston is, even if you never run it, it's an idea as much as it is a race. And there are six major international races. And when you run all of them, you get an Abbott's medal. It's like, it's a whole thing. And Sydney is just about to be made the seventh world major, which is very exciting for us. Boston Marathon has a very particular place in women's history. In 1967, Catherine Switzer was the first woman to run it. She and every woman was barred from entering the Boston Marathon. And the extraordinary thing that happened there was that her boyfriend and her coach ran side by side with her, because the officials were literally going onto the course and trying to physically pull her off the course. Mm-hmm. And other male runners who did not know her surrounded her. The thought of that kind of that community. And so she finished.
Traffic jams, tailgating, pileups. Ugh, the joys of driving. How could it get worse? The federal government wants to have a say in what you drive. That's right. The Biden administration's EPA is pushing mandates that would ban 2 out of every 3 vehicles on the road today. Don't let Washington become your backseat driver. Protect the freedom of driving your way. Visit energycitizens.org. Paid for by the American Petroleum Institute.
Make the most of your me time with sensational hair products from Method. The new range of shampoos and conditioners will leave your hair looking shiny and feeling healthy. From Pure Peace, infused with peony, rose water, and quinoa protein, to Simply Nourish, crafted with coconut, rice milk and shea butter, and Daily Zen with calming cucumber, seaweed, and green tea. Visit methodproducts.com to unleash your inner shower with Method and reconnect with the best version of yourself.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Life is full of things to manage: your work, your family, your plans, and your treatment. Consider Kesimpta, ofatumumab 20 milligram injection. You can take it yourself from the comfort of home. If you're ready for something different, ask your healthcare provider about Kesimpta and check out the details at kesimpta.com. Brought to you by Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation.
So let's talk about this property. Mari, what are your overall views on this three-parter?
Man, I can't say enough good things about it. I think this is one of these docuseries where I was like, oh, a three-parter was perfect. Shocker. Me saying three parts is okay. Like, I think that it progressively got better as each episode compounded on itself. I love the way that they did the timeline of breaking it down hour by hour. I thought the talking heads were all like, thank you, you know, higher power, because every talking head was there for a reason. They added to the documentary, the docuseries. It felt like they all had a place. And I loved how they were introduced. I loved how, like, even some information about each talking head was kind of like not obscured from us, but kind of left to unfold as the events unfold. Like, it is such a breath of fresh air from when we did the Jared documentary. And we're like, why are they throwing his fifth grade teacher in here for no reason? You know what I'm saying? Like, I thought the talking heads here were phenomenal to me. I thought they were amazing. So I thought this was a great documentary. I think it hits on, it unearthed a lot of information that I didn't know, because Mary talks about where she was when the Boston Marathon bombing happened. I know exactly where I was. I was at work. Like, I was like a 23-year-old. I had just started my second job. Like, I'd been there for like a few weeks, and I was like in this thing where I was waking up early doing training and all this stuff. And I just remember being so tired and hearing about the Boston Marathon bombing, be like, wow, that's crazy. But I never followed it. I didn't follow it. It wasn't until, you know, 4 days later when they're like, oh, we have those pictures. And then I remember when the pictures went up and they were following them. And that's when I kind of like got a little bit more into it, but I never honestly really, really followed the case. I just knew about the case. You know what I'm saying? It's one of those cases that goes down in history. It's like Oklahoma City, you know, it's the Oklahoma City bombing. It's like, you know about it, but I didn't know a lot of these details that this documentary did. And I loved seeing the different perspectives that this documentary provided for us.
Oh, absolutely. Co-sign all of that. Mary, mm-hmm. What were your overall thoughts on the documentary that we watched?
Yeah, it was a refresher on what it felt like to watch the whole thing live. Yeah, I mentioned I heard about it when I was in school, and then I came home and we followed all of the news coverage unfolding over the next several days. And I remember the clips from the documentary where they were showing the helicopter footage. Mm-hmm. Looking into the boat at the end, I'm like, oh, I have a vivid memory of seeing this. Mm-hmm. I know. Years before anyone in my family ran the Boston Marathon, You know, this is like the early 2000s. There's not, you can't just like watch live streaming on the internet easily and stuff. So there's no, you know, the Boston Marathon is big, but running in general, it's not on ESPN, right? It's not on TV for the most part. So I remember like huddling around my parents' computer. We're all huddling around the box computer, like trying to watch the marathon coverage, looking at the elite runners and following that. So this was a different experience of we're huddled around the TV watching the coverage of what's going on in Boston. The documentary itself, I completely agree with you, Mari, that the talking heads were all really informative. They structured it in a very interesting way. And then, you know, introduced certain people that at certain times. The first part of the documentary was mostly about the race and the initial bombs going off. The second part was about the chase and everything with the car captured. And then the third part is a lot more background of who these people were and how they might have gotten to this point, which I thought was perhaps if this had only been a one or two parter, we might not have gotten into that as much. And so that was very fascinating to see how they piece that together. You know, there's so many people that they talk to from the schoolmates to the boxing coach in particular that I thought just how I think both of them at different times, but especially the classmate Yusuf mentioned feeling betrayed, right? Yeah. By someone you thought you knew. And that was also something that is just like, just gutted me. You know, that him and the spectator, Karen were Karen. The two who I was, who I just felt for so personally. And then like, I mean, I could probably talk for 2 hours on Danny's whole journey and like everything that happened to him, because that is, that's the kind of thing where if I was Danny, you write a book about your experience.
Yeah.
So Mary's referring to Danny Meng. He was a tech entrepreneur. He's a migrant from China. And there is a trickling theme of, you know, the American dream and American achievements and, you know, come to this country and make a life. And Danny, from the outside, very successful. He bought his first car, which he called his baby. It was a Mercedes. And he loved it so much that he knew off by heart its GPS number, tracking number. He was carjacked by the brothers, and they told him they were the Boston Marathon bombers, and he spent time in the car with them. Obviously, you know, you would think these are my last moments, and an extraordinary act of courage. You could say, oh yes, he was saving his own life, but in fact he was absolutely instrumental in their capture. When they stopped at a petrol station, one of the brothers went inside to buy snacks. Snacks while you're in a carjacking? I don't know these boys. He made the decision he was in the passenger seat, to escape and run and alert authorities to the fact that he knew where the Boston Marathon bombers were. And we have CCTV of him running. It's sort of a bit of black humor where you think, my God, he's going fast. I mean, I've never, that sprint, and that was a sprint for his life.
So Danny Meng here is like an unsung hero of this whole entire thing, because if he doesn't manage to escape and tell them that they are in his perfectly trackable Mercedes SUV, then the cops basically have no leads, you know what I'm saying, after they've killed a MIT officer. They're so busy at the scene of the murder of Sean Collier that, you know, Danny Meng is carjacked just, you know, a few miles away or whatever, and his brave attempt to get away and the success of that, and then him just being so in love with his car, which I love that for him, is what helps capture them. And what helps, because he said that they told him, they asked him if the car could go to New York. So this could have been a completely even worse situation if the perpetrators managed to get out of Boston and on the run. even further. Like if they had managed to take Danny Ming's life and the cops had no leads on that, we could have been looking at another series of attacks. So I just thought that his story was so great. And I love them including that in here. Again, the talking heads were really great. I also really appreciate them telling Yusef's story and the imam's story, because addressing the Islamophobia of it mm-hmm. all, I thought brought a really good balance to this documentary, because it can easily become like propaganda. And this was one of those docu-series where I was like, oh my God, some of the police did a great job.
ACAB, but some of them are actually okay. Yes,
yeah, exactly. So I thought that when we were first introduced to Yusef and the imam, I knew who did the Boston bombing, because of course this happened 10 years ago, but it's never been to me as like a Muslim-based terrorist attack. To me, that it's never like, I just don't categorize it as that, you know, for me, because I think that's just unfair, you know. And I think they talk about that, you know, and they talked about September 11th and how the Islamophobia had peaked, and then how they Yusef said it felt like it was getting better, and then the Boston Marathon bombings happened, and we get clips of all of the news channels and all of the wackos immediately jumping to it has to be Muslim people before it was confirmed. Mm-hmm. And Yusef and the imam saying, like, watching and saying, I hope it's not related to Islam. I hope it's not. Yes. Like, mm-hmm. I feel so bad for them. Like, I never want them to be in that position. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just horrendous. And I love that we are given that perspective. Like, this is not, you cannot take these one people's ideology and assign it to a whole swath of people. Like, that was rough. But I love these talking heads.
Absolutely. Well, let's talk a little bit about Karen Now McWatters. She was a spectator, and mm-hmm. if you listen to Floyd's interview with Rebecca, you'll find that she has never told her story. Wow. And she was with her friend Crystal, and she lost a limb. And as she was loaded into the ambulance, someone picked up her phone and said, "Oh, here's your phone," and they put it in her pocket. It was Crystal's phone. So Crystal's family and loved ones were told that she was being operated on, and Karen's loved ones were told that Karen was unaccounted for. It's mm-hmm. terrifying, but it just adds to that. And also it lets you understand the situation on the ground, the chaos mm-hmm. on the ground. They use a lot of images and a lot of footage from the day, which I loved, mm-hmm. hated, but they didn't use the very famous one of the man in the wheelchair with his leg blown up. I thought that was very sensitive. We've all seen it. We didn't mm-hmm. need to see it. So we aren't seeing... Like, every time the bomb went off, I jumped, even though I knew it was going to happen. And you see the chaos, and you see the faces, and you see blood. So be check with yourself whether you have the intestinal fortitude to watch it.
They don't hold back very much when it comes to, like you're saying, the footage from the day. Besides the one absent wheelchair photo, there was a lot of footage that probably was out there, but at the time, me being a kid, my mom probably didn't want me to see. Didn't say, "Hey, look at this."
But again, a lot of this footage is new. The documentary filmmakers carefully, solicited footage. So a lot of the personal, the camera, non-professional,
the cell phone,
So Karen and Kevin. She does say they were tracking him. One of the great things about marathons mm-hmm. is if you're not running it, but you have a friend, you can actually track them in real time. Mm-hmm. It's really cool. Murray, how did you find these two?
I thought they were great talking heads. I thought Karen bringing the voice of the victims was really good. I thought it was very I don't know if the word is masterful or whatever, but we didn't know Karen's story technically. You know, she's just a spectator, you know what I'm saying? And then when you find out like how she was affected, and they pull a camera out, and you find out she lost one of her legs and stuff like that, but she's still like a survivor and stuff. I thought it was really tastefully done. I think her talking about her friend Crystal and telling Crystal's story, I really, that's one of the things we look for here, talking about the victims. You know, I wish we learned more about Ling Xing Lu. Like, I think that was the only victim in the documentary and even the news coverage. You can tell, like, with the news coverage back in the day, that wasn't really talked about, mostly because Martin was 8 and then we get Crystal's friend here. But I wondered about her, you know, just to have total coverage about that. But, you know, if her family or friends didn't want to talk about it, I completely understand. But I thought the use of footage, I thought the use of footage was actually pretty good. I think they did a good job of not using too graphic material. I really do think they did, because we've watched stuff where there's just unsolicited, just unedited crime scene photos just here. Like, and you don't even know. And they used a lot of footage. They used a lot of footage to see different angles. But I think they did do a good job of not showing us like the bloodier aspects and you know, no body. We didn't see any bodies. Like, I think that they did a good job of giving you an understanding of what happened and the chaos and the, you know, destruction without being overly graphic. And honestly, that's all we can ask for with some of these documentaries.
Yeah. I mean, we did see Crystal and Karen on the ground holding hands, which was amazing. And that's how Kevin knew that that there was a problem, because he actually saw it on the news.
I think I noticed in a lot of those photos, like, I think they were people were shielding like Crystal as well. Like,
yeah.
Right. Yeah.
Mary, there's a part of this that I found particularly fascinating, and that was the not just split screen, but three screen split of Rick DeLaurier, the FBI special agent in charge, of Carmen Ortiz, the U.S. attorney for Massachusetts, and Ed Davis, the police commissioner. They had very different views on how this manhunt should proceed, particularly once the photographs were identified. Do you want to talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, that was something I thought was really interesting about the documentary was, you know, Mari mentioned that with something like this, especially with the very like Boston strong, Boston community kind of element, there is a way that an event like this can turn into like propaganda, like you said. Mm-hmm. And what I thought was really interesting is that they clearly showed, and I'm not going to say it's unbiased, but they showed different sides of law enforcement disagreeing. And I felt like they were, whenever they would do that three-way split screen, sometimes they weren't even saying anything. It was just expressions, just looks. And I thought this is a case of disagreement among law enforcement. And this is that the moments you're talking about are specifically when they were discussing whether or not they should release the photographs of the suspects to the public. And this is all happening within probably within the first like 30 hours ish of the bombing. I have the times written down.
I think
somewhere.
They said they had identified the suspects' photos on Wednesday, and they had released the photos to the press on Thursday. So.
And they released them because there was a leak. This is the interesting thing, because Ed Davis, the police commissioner, wants to release the photographs, and Carmen Ortiz, the attorney, and Rick DeLaurier, the FBI person, does not want to. Lo and behold, there's a leak of the photographs to the press, and so they have to hold a press conference. Sorry, Mary, do go on.
Yeah, so I can see both sides about what they're saying. You know, the Ed's perspective is, if we release these photographs now, first off, has everyone being vigilant of who to look out for? We can use the internet to help source who these suspects might be, and hopefully someone will just recognize them and come forward and tell us, which are all positives of doing that. You know, there's so many cases now where, because of the internet and social media and connectivity, people can identify suspects so much quicker and do that sleuthing. At this time in 2013, and you know, they talk a lot in the documentary about all of the evidence that is coming in from the spectators, from the runners, from the people who just live in the area. They've got photographs, they've got whatever, because I know from being at marathons, you're constantly taking pictures and filming things. You're trying to capture all those moments. So there's so much footage of what can be happened or what happened on top of the CCTV and the security footage from the various businesses on Boylston Street. So I can see the reason to want to release the photos. Now, the FBI's perspective is, we release the photos, then we no longer have control over the situation. The suspects know that we know who they are. They can see this. They can start, you know, running, they can hide. And the other one is, it might force their hand to attack again if they think, oh, I've only got a certain amount of time left. They're on my heels, whatever. Which I can also understand. And I think there might even be potentially, you know, another way. I don't know if anyone was thinking this, but I'm thinking, let's just say that one or both of these people was not actually someone who committed the crime. You have now said public manhunt on someone who could potentially be innocent. Now, that's not the case, and I'm sure that they had enough evidence, probably even more than they saw in the documentary, that they were sure that these were the people. You know, we see them on camera walking with backpacks, putting the backpacks down and walking away without backpacks. It's pretty cut and dry that it's them. But just in case, you know, there are so many cases of people who get accused of crimes they didn't commit. So just in case that's the answer, do you want random Joe Schmo who wants to be a hero, see one of them walking down the street and they're actually innocent and goes after them? Probably not. Right. So, you know, that's
or someone who looks remarkably like them.
Or who looks remarkably like him. Exactly.
Yeah. Yusuf, when the photographs are released, one of his friends says, oh, isn't this Jaha? And Yusuf says, no, it's not. It can't be. And it was. So there's some of the usefulness as well. Although Jaha's roommates did dispose of evidence, shall we say, take everything from his room to the dump. So they knew who he was. Apparently that's not it's not a crime to know who someone is and not say anything.
They said they were eventually charged of obstruction of justice. So
with the disposal of the
disposal. And I don't know if that was also included on the not coming forth with the information they had, but they definitely were trying to get away with disposing of things. You know, maybe they didn't know up until that moment, searched his room, found some things, and just wanted to separate themselves from the situation. I don't know.
They're like 19, so
this is college students. You have no idea, right? I mean, you know, if you find your college roommate with some alcohol when they're not supposed to have it, you might, you know, you're probably not necessarily going to turn them in. I know this is a completely different scenario, but I'm saying they're kids. They might not know.
I think to the 19-year-old brain, it's a very similar, you know, it's a very
probably
similar,
it's so like that just unlocked a memory for me, Mary. I remember walking into my college dorm room and watching one of my roommates in there with a dude like packing weed to sell. And I literally opened the door, looked at the situation, dropped my bag and closed it and went to my friend's rooms. Like, can you believe she's doing this? Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, it's so true. It's like, I can see how 19-year-old brains don't realize what they're doing when they're disposing of evidence in a nationwide terrorist attack. Like, geez, Louise. But don't do that. Don't dispose of evidence out there, y'all, please.
Yeah. And I have said to my nephew, who's a young 23-year-old man, you know, I have said to him, I love you, but if you murder someone, come and tell me and I will turn you into the police. But I do love you. I love you, but that's what's going to happen. Not that he's about to, but, you know. So the release of the photographs does seem to have the effect that the FBI feared it would, because the brothers have more pipe bombs and pressure cooker bombs in the back of their car, which they load into the back of Danny's car. Mm-hmm. And as Murray said, the intention was to drive to New York. So
Where do you stand on the side of releasing the photos or not releasing the photos?
It's hard not to be results oriented. Mm-hmm. Because although it's not necessarily a direct line, the photos are released and within hours, Sean Collier is dead and Danny mm-hmm. Ming's car has been hijacked and they are literally on the way to New York with mm-hmm. pipe bombs and pressure cooker bombs in the back of their car. I think where I stand is that they were leaked and I think that was a deliberate act to get the official release of the photographs. Mm-hmm. Mary, what about you?
It's so tricky because I'm trying to remember back to what I thought at the time when I was, 17, 18 years old when this was happening. And I probably thought, oh yes, release the photos. We should know who to, look mm-hmm. out for or whatever. The people of Boston need to be aware. But now thinking about it, I feel like I think what it really comes down to is if they had any leads, if they had any way where they thought they were going to be able to find them or track them without releasing the photos, then I can understand wanting to wait. But at the point when they eventually do release them, it's been a day later from mm-hmm. when they found it. Yep. Were they any farther? And if they weren't any farther, I think when it comes down to finding who they were, it didn't end up mattering. What mattered was Danny Meng, right? What mattered was the carjacking, which is what makes this such a
tricky. It makes it tricky
experience mm. because if they hadn't released the photos and the brothers went back to their apartment and no one, maybe they even left town or something just on their own, but weren't pressured to by trying to get away. Maybe they spend more time making more weapons. Maybe exactly. they get away and they go, go somewhere else regardless. So in some ways, the sort of call to action, it did spur them to act, but it also spurred them to get caught faster than maybe they would have. So I can see it both ways. I think nowadays they can't, things get leaked to the internet so quickly that mm-hmm. I'm sure this wouldn't, it would just be a no brainer that it would be happening. I mean, people on the scene would probably be, and they were even at the time, just showing pictures,
random
photos of anybody with a backpack, anybody in the area.
I remember those. Yeah.
Yep. Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I completely agree with Mary. I think it's pros and cons of both sides, but I personally think that it was the right decision to release the names because, like they said in the documentary, like Mary pointed out, they didn't have any like fresh leads, and so it's kind of like I'm trying to think. I don't think it was Bundy. But when it might have been Bundy, it might have been the sorority house killings. But it's like when serial killers or serial bombers or mass shooters are spurned to action where they are in that fight or flight mode, it will trigger them to probably commit more violence, but it also triggers them to make more mistakes. And when they make more mistakes, that's how you catch them. That's how we caught both brothers this time, because they made a mistake in carjacking Danny Ming. So I completely agree with Mary. I think if you don't release those, photos and you sit on that information, you're also not being fair to the people of Boston who don't know that they're, dangerous people lurking around. Again, in cases of serial killers or serial murderers, if you don't alert the public, they are at risk for
That's
being
true.
Harmed.
Yeah. And there's anger afterwards. You knew and you didn't tell us.
Either way, it's kind of like Sarah said, it's very results oriented. And I did kind of agree with Ed when he said that the Sean Collier killing, they needed a gun. It was probably bound to happen no matter what they did. But we don't know. We really can't say that. So,
yeah.
So I do think that it was the right choice because it ultimately led to their capture.
Yes. Well, the death of one and the capture of the other, mm-hmm. as our FBI so vividly says, you can't interview a corpse. So they were very keen to get these brothers alive so they could find out if they were part of a cell, what their relationships were. And we hear from David Filipov, who's a Boston Globe reporter. Very interesting interview. The talking heads are very much that we see in chapter one, we see all the way through. We add in Danny Meng in chapter two and David Filipov, who is, I won't say much more about him. He's a very interesting addition and has an entirely other side to talk about. So the last thing that I just want to say, talk about is the lockdown. Lockdown of a day made the people of Boston angry.
Not even
how
a day.
Extraordinary was it?
It was like 8 hours. Yeah.
So watch this lockdown from our position here, Mary.
Oh, how times have changed. One day of lockdown. Yeah.
Obama himself said, oh, you can't lock down a metropolitan city.
That one didn't age super well. That part was interesting also because they showed the area and it's like, I mean, multiple separate cities. It's not just Boston. Mm-hmm. It's not just Watertown. It's not just Cambridge. It was like five or six separate counties. And the fact that they mentioned that they had law enforcement from like multiple other states coming.
Like Rhode Island.
So they have all these people here and it's just basically the streets are empty. It's a ghost town except for the law enforcement out looking for this person. So they perform the lockdown after, because it's kind of like several parts, right? There's the bombing and then they escape. And then there's the
shootout,
senseless murder of the campus police officer who's just sitting in his car in order to try and get a gun that they don't even get from him, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
Sean Collier. And so then after that happens, that's when they do the carjacking of Danny Meng's car, and carjacking and like kidnapping essentially, or hostage situation. Then after Danny escapes, that is when he and the two brothers end up in Watertown, where the Watertown Police Department is informed that there's a carjacking. Somehow the message doesn't get to them or intentionally doesn't get to them, but these are the same people from the bombing. So they go to this situation thinking this is a couple teenagers who've, you know, carjacked
with a gun,
a vehicle. They know they're armed. They know they have a gun. Mm-hmm. They don't know that they've got a trunk full of boxes of explosives as well. Which turns into this massive shootout. I think they said at one point that it was like 200 and something bullets that end up in people's houses nearby. They say it's pure luck that no innocent civilians were injured or killed in this event. And because it's like in a suburban street, right? It just houses on all sides where this shootout happens. For me, the clip that stuck with me almost most from this video is the clip of after one of the brothers, I think it's the older brother. He runs out of bullets. So he just sort of runs at the police officers. They apprehend him. They have him on the ground. But while that has all happened, the younger brother gets in the car and drives over his brother's body. I'm assuming at trying to just escape and run through the police officers. The police officers managed to dive out of the way. And that was something that it jogged my memory that had happened, but I don't think that I had seen that clip before.
I don't think I knew that. I know I didn't know that. That was shocking to me. I do want to talk about the shootout just real quick, Sarah. Mm-hmm. Like Mary said, the absolute luck that nobody was injured in this shootout, patrolman John McClellan, this is where we're introduced to him And I thought, again, I was like, why are you making me like the police?
He's never shot his gun before.
Ever. Exactly. Like he was talking about like Watertown and him being a patrolman. And he was the one who told us that he just thought it was a carjacking with a couple kids. And him and the two officers with him, they did some really good police work, I think, like pinning the suspects down. But then the suspects started lobbing like pipe bombs at them on a residential street, like Mary said. And what occurs with the more than 210 bullets, once they radio that, hey, the guys are here, all of the other cops from Sean Collier's murder scene roll up to Watertown, and then they start shooting. And then this is where I'm like, okay, good policing meets bad policing, because there, I'm going to assume that a good portion of those 200 bullets, I'm assuming, didn't come from three men. You know, mm-hmm. It came from the people who rolled up. And I like how the documentary portrays this, because we're getting some footage. We're getting camera footage. I think at one point in the documentary, it also says that some of the CCTV footage is recreated. Mm-hmm. And we'll talk about the recreation. I'll talk about it in my ratings at least. But like, I thought it was done pretty well. But as it was happening, I was like, that is a lot of bullets just mm-hmm. flying everywhere. I like how they had Philip Martin, another investigative reporter, talking about how he was on multiple scenes that day, and he was the one who told us about how all of the rounds went into different houses. We got pictures from rounds going into people's houses, and I was like, oh, I knew it. Like, I was like, this is too much shooting for it not to have gone awry. But luckily it didn't go left, because we're just so glad that nobody else was harmed there. So
yeah, and we're going to see this love of firepower when they finally find mm-hmm. Jahar inside a boat. And three officers, quite high ranking, creep up, no sirens, no nothing, and they're quietly in charge of the situation. And suddenly hundreds of law enforcement arrive, and then somebody starts shooting, and then they all start shooting. Jeez. Now, this is where I turned slightly, Murray, like you. I thought, here's some good policing where they are containing. I mean, the boy is bleeding. He's been lying in a boat for 18 hours. No water, no food. Scared young man. Let's get a negotiator here. Let's quietly go about it. But then the other law enforcement find out about it, and they all ride up and they all shoot. And you can hear Billy Evans say, hold your fire, hold your fire. And they do stop shooting. But I did like that clear-eyed view from the documentary makers of here's some good policing and here's some bad policing. They let us draw those conclusions.
And did you remember in that second scene with the boat, one of them, it might have been Billy Evans, he says basically, yeah, we need some reform because we experienced in this, you know, 100 hours, evidence of times when there is controlled command of situations mm-hmm. and when there is nervous firepower for no reason, basically. I mean, I'm not going to say no reason. There was a potentially armed person in a boat, but like, let's think if this person has explosive devices.
Exactly.
You were all around. There's a house
has
right
an
here.
Explosive device.
The boat has fuel in gasoline it, you know? In it. Right. So, that was, oh gosh, hearing that.
I think it was Ed Davis, the actual police commissioner, said that.
Yeah. And it was, mm-hmm. For me, I'm thinking not only that, and I understand you want to get this guy, right? All of the things that you've been through, most of these people are probably delirious with exhaustion. Mm-hmm. And you just want this to be over. You want to win and that, but like the third episode is called, you can't interview a corpse. If you want any information, maybe you don't care about answers, maybe you don't care about the why, but if you want to know, are there other people involved? Is anyone else working? Who funded this? And you want to get to the bottom of that. I mean, these are things that you don't often get in these acts of terror, because a large amount of the time, the criminal also kills themselves. And so that you mm-hmm. you don't ever find out the why. You can only speculate. And so this is a scenario where I don't know if lucky is exactly the right word, but the 126 rounds that end up hitting the boat, none of them kill Jahar inside. So
not only trigger happy, but also not very good shooters.
Well,
Let's move to our summary and ratings. Murray, do you want to start us off with your summary and your ratings out of 5 magnifying glasses?
Yeah, I really thought that this was a great piece of work. I thought the property did a really good job of covering a lot of angles and using the 3 episodes very wisely. The layout, the very clear timeline, I thought it was good. I think it truly has blended together like a lot of good elements from a lot of other docuseries that we watched that I'm like, oh my God, they picked all the good stuff out of some of these that we've seen. The one thing that I did not like, the one recreation that I did not like was in the first episode when they were doing the face blurry, scary music, like, you know what I'm saying? When they were doing the recreations of seeing Jahar in the commissary or Tamerlan in the car, when they were just blurring their faces out for no reason. I was like, this is stupid. But other than that, I could not tell which CCTV footage was recreated. I'm assuming it's a lot of the Danny Ming stuff that's not all real. But not the one I'm not talking about the gas station one. I'm talking about the one when they initially pull up to him. You think that one was real?
Oh, I was just saying that Floyd tells us that the gas station footage is all Danny. And he had a hard time watching him begging on his knees for a phone call. I mean,
no, that I got.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was wondering if it was like when they first pulled up on him, some of the stuff when they pull over in Watertown. I was like,
MIT, I think there were a couple times basically where it seemed like for clarity of the show, they kept putting them in the white and the black hat when they probably weren't still wearing the white and black hat. Mm-hmm. Like when they go up to the campus police at MIT, I felt like that one was probably a recreation. But
it's very well integrated.
We say all that to say that they did a really good job of integrating it and making those recreations tasteful and appropriate. So I'm going to give American Manhunt, the Boston Marathon Bombers, I'm going to give it a 4.5. I thought,
wow.
Yeah, I give out fives like a candy. So I actually had to like back a little bit but I think that it was good on a rewatch as well, so I'm gonna give it a 4.5.
Mary, your final thoughts and your ratings for American Manhunt, the Boston Marathon Bombing, out of a possible 5 magnifying glasses.
So I don't know how much this means considering I've just consumed so little true crime content, but especially looking at this as a documentary, I think when I think about a documentary, what I look for is clear storytelling, lots of talking heads and evidence and clips from the actual event, which this was chock full of, and being able to leave the content and feel like you have learned more than you already knew about something, even if you're an expert on it. So for me, that combined with the fact that I found it to be very personal, I'm going to give it a 5 out of 5. I really, with the exception of I did not need the sort of actor fuzzy faced like I don't even know what you'd call that, because it wasn't really a recreation. It was more like to add suspense, right?
Yeah,
like they have like, oh, look at these two, they're just sitting there watching the TV while chaos is raining outside. I don't know that added anything to the show, but especially because, and this is maybe a nitpick on my part, they didn't even try to make them look like the real people really at all. So that
like, we're going to blur it, so it's fine.
Yeah, it was like, if you're going to try and do some sort of recreation, when they had like a clip of, here's the CCTV of Jahar going into a supermarket and getting it looked like some milk or something in a carton and walking away. But then when they actually show the acting version, mm-hmm. it's like he's picking up something completely different. It wasn't even like a joke. I'm like, well, you didn't even try to make it look like it was the real thing. Yeah. Yeah. But I did really, I don't know if I could say enjoy watching it. I felt like I got something out of it. So that's what I was looking for.
Yes, I liked this very much. I think the talking heads were absolutely incredible. There was nobody that we didn't need to hear from and people that we did need to hear from. The courage of people like Karen and Kevin to speak for the first time. Even law enforcement, the on-the-ground, boots-on-the-ground officers, to talk to them was so interesting. And you can see that 10 years later, they still had to stop speaking momentarily as events hit them. The two reporters that we hear from are very interesting. The revelations that David Filipov has towards the end of his discussion with us is just such a gut punch. I won't spoil it, but it's not just there for its shocking dramatic value. It's there because it's part of the whole. And I think anything that looks at a particular story, this is one story of two brothers who did this thing, that's interesting, sort of. But what this documentary does is place it very much within a time and a mindset. The timeline is great. I love we've got the countdown to the 101 hours, but we do go back and forward and back and forward within that time. And I never felt lost. I always knew where I was. I, too, thought the recreations with the fuzzy faces were, I could have done without them. But nonetheless, I am also going to rate it a 5 out of 5. I thoroughly recommend that people watch this. It's not an easy watch, but it's a fascinating watch. It's moving. You do need to have a little bit of strength to watch it. There's nothing terribly gory, but you apprehend the tension that you and terror that you apprehend is quite strong. So I would recommend not binging it 1, 2, 3, but 1, have a pause and another. As Mari says, it really repays a second viewing as well, which I think gives it its strength. So, Mary, what have you been watching, listening to, or reading that you'd like to recommend to our listeners?
I actually have been trying to get back into reading, and I did just finish the book Tomorrow and Tomorrow and Tomorrow. So if you are interested in reading, it is a really, really interesting, and I found it to be a very personal book about two video game developers, fictional video game developers, and their friendship. And I thought it was really good. So definitely recommend that one. And Riverdale's back for its final season. So I've been watching and podcasting about that, which has been, it's like the spring right now is just Hot Mess Express with Survivor and Big Brother Canada and Riverdale. So all of those things.
Thanks, Mary. I would like to recommend Tickled. Now, Tickled is an older documentary, but it's still available on Prime in the US and Foxtel in Australia. It's about the mysterious online world of competitive tickling. And I will say no more, as you very much want to watch that completely unspoiled. So that's Tickled. Go and watch that. At Crime Scene, we're eager to hear your feedback and suggestions for future episodes. You can follow Crime Scene on Twitter at Crime Scene RHAP. That's Scene, S-E-E-N. Or email us at crimescenerhap@gmail.com.
We're on TikTok at crime.scene and on Instagram and Facebook at Crime Scene Podcast. And remember to subscribe to our feed, robhasawebsite.com/crimefeed. It makes a big difference.
Sure does. Mary, what have you got going on and where can people find you?
I am everywhere at Frail Mary, so you can check out everything that I'm covering, podcasting, and thinking about over on Frail Mary at Twitter. I'm also just announced today that I am doing an interesting project over the summer. We've talked about running here, and I am doing a live Survivor game for charity over the summer. So if anybody is interested in Survivor or raising money or following that, I am selected the nonprofit, the Virginia Capital Trail Foundation. So they promote well-being and athleticism in your community, as well as transportation. And they're trying to connect multiple different trail systems in the state of Virginia. So it's very personal to me, and I am supporting them. So if you'd like to find out about that, then you can just check out my Twitter as well.
Wonderful. And what about you, Mari? What have you got going on?
So the Connect on post-show recaps just wrapped up our coverage of snowfall. I mean, we are devastated, but we are glad that we could have covered the sixth and final season of Snowfall. We are currently looking for something else to cover because we also wrapped up our Swarm coverage as well a few weeks ago. So if you have anything that you want to suggest that the Connect cover, remember, we got y'all, and you can send us your suggestions. Send them to connect@postshowrecaps.com so that we can hear everything you have to suggest. Go follow me on Twitter at Mari Talks Too Much. That's two, like the number two. I'm also covering like Big Brother Canada. I've been on some Survivor podcasts recently. So right now the Wrestling Wrap Up is on hiatus. So if you want to know what I'm doing in between crime scene, follow me on Twitter, and I'll post everything there. Also, please go follow me at twitch.tv/MariTalksTooMuch as well there. I've been doing some gaming. It's been really fun just being creative over there. I'm going to start like podcasting random things over there too. So just go and follow so you get notified for when I go live. Sarah, what do you got going on?
People can follow me on Twitter at Sarah Carradine if that's something that they would like to do. I will be covering Love and Death, the dramatization of the Candy Montgomery, Betty Gore, ex-murder case from 1980 with LaTanya Starks. The drama is on HBO in the US and Binge in Australia, and our podcast coverage will be weekly on post-show recaps. I covered Candy for PSR last year, which is a dramatization of the same case, and it was absolutely excellent. So Love and Death has some very big slingbacks to fill. Also on PSR, Dark Walk crew of Sasha, Kirsten, Geneva, and me are reassembling to cover Queen Charlotte, a Bridgerton story. And that will be starting next week. And speaking of next week, Mari, what's next?
Next time on Crime Scene, we're covering Pretty Baby with Chantel Francis. You can watch it on Hulu and send us your comments and questions.
Thanks to Mary Kwiatkowski for joining us, Will from America for the theme music, and Scott St. Pierre and the whole RHAP team behind the scenes. Until next time, case closed.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you wanna get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Judy was boring.
Hello.
Then Judy discovered ChumbaCasino.com.
It's my little escape.
Now Judy's the life of the party.
Oh, baby, mama's bringing home the bacon.
Whoa, take it easy, Judy. The Chumba life is for everybody. So go to ChumbaCasino.com and play over 100 casino-style games. Join today and play for free for your chance to redeem some serious prizes. ChumbaCasino.com. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Hello, it is Ryan, and we could all use an extra bright spot in our day, couldn't we? Just to make up for things like sitting in traffic, doing the dishes, counting your steps, you know, all the mundane stuff. That is why I'm such a big fan of Chumba Casino. Chumba Casino has all your favorite social casino-style games that you can play for free anytime, anywhere with daily bonuses. That should brighten your day a little. Actually, a lot. So sign up now at chumbacasino.com. That's chumbacasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.